Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. We've got a great guest to kick off what we're basically calling Foreign Policy Week at The Realignment. Speaking with Dmytro Perovich, author of Word on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. This conversation and the book are all about Dmytro's belief that Xi Jinping is preparing to seize Taiwan in the coming years, a decision that could be incredibly disastrous for both the United States and the world if he's not deterred from doing so. Dmytro famously predicted in 2021 that Vladimir Putin would invade Ukraine in 2022 at a time that the belief was not widely held beyond certain parts of the intelligence community. So Dmytro's perspective on these issues, I think, is incredibly relevant as we kind of focus in on the centrality of the Taiwan question to the next few years of American foreign and, as we discuss, domestic policy. Hope you all enjoy the conversation, and a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Dmytro Perovich, welcome to The Realignment.
Great to be with you, Marshall.
Your new book starts off describing a Taiwan invasion scenario, but it's a little different than I think the scenario a lot of folks are going to have in mind. It doesn't take place in 2027. It's not primarily amphibious in terms of how it actually kicks off. So how about you just sort of start by explaining why you tell the probable story of what an invasion would look like in a way that's going to be a little different than our expectations?
Absolutely. So the book that I wrote, The World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century, really sounds the alarm bells about this looming conflict that we face with China over Taiwan. I was one of the early geopolitical analysts to have predicted the invasion of Ukraine in December of 2021, almost 3 months before the start of that conflict. And the same reasons that I saw playing out in Europe with the drive that Putin had to invade Ukraine, I see really transferring to that region as well, and particularly driving the ego of one person, one authoritarian leader, Xi Jinping, in the case of Asia, to undertake that invasion. I spent a lot of time working on this issue, doing a lot of research on the island itself, on Taiwan, and not just speaking with the leadership of that country and the military and the intelligence folks there, but also walking the terrain and thinking through how I would invade Taiwan if I were China. Because this really, for people that haven't been there, they may not appreciate how incredibly difficult the terrain is on Taiwan. It is full of mountains, rivers, tunnels, bridges. This is not the plains of Ukraine. This is not Normandy that I think a lot of people have this sort of view that this would be sort of Saving Private Ryan, Chinese edition, Higgins boats or Chinese versions of them landing on the beaches and, you know, expanding from there. And that's just not the reality of Taiwan. There are very few beaches. They're very rocky, very small. They're fire controlled from the neighboring hills. And the worst thing is that you land on the beach and you have nowhere to go because in most cases you're up against mountains. So when I was thinking about how this invasion might be undertaken, and clearly the Chinese are preparing for it, I came up with this scenario, again, in consultation with many folks. A good friend of mine, Ivan Kanapathy, was the military attaché to Taiwan. We toured the island together, thinking through how this one unfolds, and it becomes clear that you really have to take the infrastructure. You have to do an airborne assault on key facilities on Taiwan, the port, the airfields, in order to be able to actually unload the hundreds of thousands of troops you're going to need, thousands of armored vehicles and tanks, and numerous logistics that are required to actually take over this island of 23 million people. So the book starts out with a fictional, but I think fairly realistic scenario of how this might happen. Now, the date, as you rightly point out, the scenario is set in late 2028, not 2027. And I actually think that an invasion in 2027 is highly, highly unlikely. A lot has been made out of the warnings from CIA Director Burns about Xi Jinping giving the order to the PLA to be ready by 2027. And I think, you know, our intelligence on that is very likely highly accurate. However, we have to appreciate that that order is, A, largely a political order. Remember, what is happening in 2027? Well, Xi Jinping is up for re-election for an unprecedented fourth term. And he would love nothing more than to go up in front of the Chinese Party Congress. Of course, he's not getting reelected by the Chinese leadership, only the Chinese Communist Party. And he would love to announce this incredible accomplishment of being ready to invade Taiwan whenever he wants, right? No doubt that would help them and build the case that he should get yet another term as the leader of the Communist Party. I also think that the invasion is unlikely to be taken in 2027 because precisely of that election, the Chinese Communist Party, that this is not a foregone conclusion. I mean, most likely he's going to win re-election, but he needs to make sure that everything is absolutely tightened up in terms of any potential opposition that he's particularly given what's going on with the economy right now, the stagnation and growth that China is witnessing, that he is going to have full support of everyone on the Politburo and within the broader Communist Party. So undertaking something this risky with these huge stakes in the middle of that process, I think is very unlikely. Plus, just because he's given the order to be ready by 2027 doesn't mean that they actually will be ready. Because as we know, just because you tell a government agency to be ready by a certain date, whether that government agency is in the United States or China, doesn't mean that they actually get there. So I think for those and other reasons, it probably won't take in 2027. But in late 2028, I think the window does open up. It doesn't mean that he's going to invade right away, but somewhere in that late 28 through 2032, which is going to be the end of his fourth term, I think you have a high degree of likelihood that he's going to launch an invasion.
What I appreciate about the book is you do a great job of merging both the present day crisis in Ukraine and then this probable crisis with Taiwan. And when you're writing about Vladimir Putin, it's easy to kind of overdo the Putin is Hitler metaphor comparisons. But I think a way you could argue the personalities are simpler is that they're gamblers. You write about how Putin has been a gambler throughout his career. So if we're thinking about the way you just articulated Xi Jinping's incentives and the way he's approaching this issue in 2027, 2028, to what degree do you think he's a gambler? What is his appetite for risks? I feel like that's one of the means by which we should assess the dangers here.
Yeah, I don't think he is as much of a gambler as Putin. And, you know, as you rightly say, I write in the book about all the gambles that Putin has undertaken, invading Chechnya for a second time, just 3 years after a disastrous loss by Russia in that conflict, obviously Ukraine, Crimea, invading Georgia. All of these things could have gone very badly for him in Ukraine. I think the jury is still out whether that's going to bring down his regime or not. But he rolls the dice, and for a long time, he's been very, very lucky, and Ukraine may be the one issue on which his luck may run out. We'll have to see. Xi Jinping is a little bit more cautious, but he's also done things that are quite counterproductive, and Wolf Warrior diplomacy is a great example of that, where he's managed to alienate not just the West, but many of potential friends and partners in the region, where no one in the region is looking at China with a favorable light now because of the aggressive undertakings that he's forced on the system. When you look at the Philippines, what's happening right now, that for the first time in 30 years, United States troops are building bases on the Philippines yet again. That would not have happened without the aggression from China against the Philippines, particularly in the second Thomas Shoal, this set of rocks in the South China Sea. There's a disputed territory between the Philippines and China. What's happening in Japan, with Japan ramping up its militarization, moving away from its self-defense-focused approach on the military, largely because of the threat of China. Taiwan obviously building up its own military as well. We have Xi Jinping to thank for all of that. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he's been so cavalier about the economics of investment in growth and also attracting investments. He's famously cracked down on people like Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba and the broader tech sector in China. He's arrested business leaders from the West. He's made it really a terrible climate for investment, which is one of the reasons why you've seen foreign direct investment to China just absolutely plummet in the last year, 20% year over year decrease from the numbers that just came out about a month ago. So all of those things really suggest to you that this is a man that is impatient, that thinks the time has come for China to assert itself on the global stage, to become the preeminent power. I think he's largely miscalculated when he saw 2008, when he saw the chaos in the U.S. domestic politics post 2016 and 2020, and he assumed that America is too weak and now is the time to bring China out on the world stage as a preeminent superpower. He was too early. He ignored the guidance of Deng Xiaoping, who, of course, famously said, "Hide your strength, bide your time." And I write in the book that Xi Jinping basically turned it into "show off your strength, waste no time." And as a result, I think he's Chinese power has peaked, and he's helped the United States to build a much bigger, broader coalition, both in the region and worldwide, to confront authoritarianism.
I think what's really fascinating there, to your point about Xi not necessarily being a gambler, but being a person who's miscalculated. I'm sure you remember when he gave his 27 speech in Davos after Trump's election, where he very much, I think this is a good political move to say China is stable, China is picking up this world order, China's focused on climate change. But then something happens over the next few years where he responds to the Trumpian chaos by seeing it as an opportunity to move. So the moves when it came to Hong Kong, the war for air diplomacy, the way they handled the post-COVID period, not understanding that the Trumpian moment actually led to an actual bipartisan consensus towards the Trumpian position in the United States. Like, it's hard to imagine a world where the overwhelming majority of Congress isn't voting in favor of a TikTok ban without the reckless actions of Xi. So I think that's just like a useful way of understanding the mix of adverse to his interest behaviors. So I guess the next question for you would really be, you do this really helpful way of articulating our actual foreign policy aim here, because you have this post-1990s critique of U.S. foreign policy as being listless and prone to distraction. And you basically just say, in the original Latin, obviously, that deterring Chinese military force from attacking Taiwan should be the central organizing principle of the next few years. Is that a good way of summarizing how you would organize the way we think of foreign policy challenges?
Yeah, I would say the main argument in the book is that we are unquestionably in Cold War II, and one that is actually remarkably similar to Cold War I on nearly every aspect of that competition. I mean, we have a global competition for supremacy yet again. We have an arms race, both a conventional arms race and a nuclear arms race, with China building up its nuclear arsenals from about 300 warheads that they had at the beginning of 2020 to about 1,000 that they're expected to have by the end of the decade. You have a space race, both countries trying to obviously both get to the moon once again, get to Mars in the coming decade, and invest heavily in surveillance, communications, navigation satellites, and low Earth orbit. You have an ideological struggle. It's not communism versus capitalism, but it's authoritarianism versus democracy. And this administration talks a lot about that. You have the preparations for war, like we had, you know, during the Cold War, that the Pentagon right now is preparing for a fight with China in the Indo-Pacific, a fight that would be just unimaginably difficult and costly for us, and could potentially even result in a nuclear confrontation. You have a scramble for bases, where we are once again trying to secure bases in the region. The Chinese are trying to do the same thing with their partners and allies. You have an espionage war that actually eclipsed anything we had seen in the first Cold War, in part because of the developments in cyber. So on every level, you have a very similar competition that has arisen. And even on the economic front, which is sort of the one argument that you sometimes hear from people, is that we can't be in a Cold War with China because of the interdependence of our economies. I actually go through the first Cold War history and talk about how there was quite a few technology transfers with the Soviet Union. There was both on the military front and on the civilian front, where much of the infrastructure of the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s was built by Western industrialists from Germany, from the UK, and from the United States. And even throughout the Cold War, the U.S., the Soviet oil and gas industry, the fossil fuel industry that financed, as it does today, much of the regime and the arms race was running off Western technologies. So we were, in fact, enabling our enemy, just like we are enabling China today and have enabled them over the last 40 plus years. So the similarities are remarkable. And the book really articulates, if we're in a Cold War II, what is our grand strategy for victory? And yes, I do argue for focus. I do not argue for abandonment of Ukraine, as some do. I do not think that we should be pulling out of every other region of the world, but we should be focused on the defeat of China in this Cold War and victory for the United States. And what does that defeat actually mean? Because that is probably the biggest divergence between Cold War I and Cold War II, because the insight that George Kennan had when he wrote his long telegram outlining what ended up becoming the strategy for winning Cold War I, it was the realization that the Soviet Union was in a natural phenomenon, this amalgamation of different ethnic nations like Ukraine that would one day separate and the Soviet Union would fall apart. Well, China is very different, mm-hmm. right? China is a homogeneous society. Almost all Chinese are Han Chinese, or vast majority of them. And China is not going anywhere. It's been around for thousands of years. It'll be around for many thousands of years more. So that is not sort of what we're trying to achieve here. We're not trying to destroy China. We're not trying to make China fall apart. But we are trying to deter its ambitions in Taiwan and the broader Asia region, because really the domination of Taiwan leads to domination of Asia, and domination of Asia leads to domination of the world. That has been true for centuries, really, when you look at the geographies and geopolitics of that region, and particularly in the last century. And that is what is at stake for the United States, and that's why we do need to deter China. Close the book in Latin with the phrase "Sina deterrenda sunt," which means China must be deterred, and that does need to be a huge focus of our efforts.
Yeah, and I think that correct me if I got my history wrong, but you're echoing Cato the Elder would famously say, you know, "Carthago detenda est," close all his speeches. Carthage must be destroyed. Luckily, in the modern iteration of this, it's not destruction. It's not overthrowing a regime.
Yeah, I'm not arguing for destruction of China, to be clear.
It's very clearly but the status quo seems nice. Let's keep maintaining that as a bottom line organizing principle. You know, something I'm curious about in your articulation of the cost of China taking Taiwan, obviously you get into semiconductors and chip fabs, but you didn't just mention semiconductors and chip fabs. And a worry that I have is that in an effort to get Americans to care, in an effort to make this about American interests, there's a part of the pro-Taiwan wing within both parties that have over-focused on the semiconductor question, which I think long-term, we'll get into this in Ukraine, is going to lead this in a negative place, because from a political perspective, where my expertise comes from, the obvious response is, look, I'm not going to send my son or daughter to die because I might not get my newest Ford Bronco. I'll stick with the 2021 version, even if the chip quite isn't as fast. So I'm curious how you think the semiconductor to broader geopolitical worth and interest in Taiwan, how we balance these things together, because I don't want to turn this into a blood for semiconductors, i.e. a blood for oil critique from the 21st century of Iraq, which I don't think we fought the Iraq war for oil, of course, but I do think that critics of Taiwan policy will very quickly glom onto the vulnerabilities of making this purely about resources and technological power.
Yeah, you've heard this over the last year or two that Taiwan matters to us because of chips. And look, chips are unquestionably important. And I talk about the importance of chips, the importance of other technologies that are built using chips and how they're critical for winning the race for the 21st century. But I think it's frankly both a mistake and an insult to reduce Taiwan to chips, because Taiwan has mattered to the United States long before chips were even a thing, long before we entered the age of computing. In fact, I quote Douglas MacArthur in 1950. He said, Formosa, Taiwan was called at the time, is an unsinkable aircraft carrier. And you have to understand the geography of that region. And I show this map in the book of China and Taiwan, but it's a different map from the one that everyone sort of looks at, where you have the huge mass of China and this little speck of land next to it, a few hundred miles off its shore, that is Taiwan. And people naturally in this country would ask, why does it matter? We are far away. It seems like Taiwan has always belonged in China. By the way, I talk in the book that about the history of Taiwan and how that is actually a false perception, that there's never been a single moment in Taiwan's history where whoever fully controlled China also fully controlled Taiwan. But aside from that, if you rotate the map, if you sort of put China up top and looking out at the world, from Chinese perspective, you see themselves viewing themselves as completely surrounded by the United States military and U.S. bases and allies around the world, right? So if you look sort of to your east, immediately east, if you're China, you're looking at the Korean Peninsula, half of which, of course, is South Korea, and having a significant contingent of U.S. military there. Further down, you see the Japanese islands, where, again, you have U.S. Marines on Okinawa and various other places around the Japanese islands. At the very center, looking straight out, you see Taiwan, that is viewed as an outpost of American power. And Taiwan is really that anchor point, that cork that keeps China bottled up. And to the west of it, of course, you have the Philippine Islands, where you once again have U.S. military bases. So China, as it's looking out at the world, feels itself contained essentially by this first island chain, as it's often called. And when you think about its trade routes, all of its trade is coming through, maritime trade is coming through the choke points in that first island chain, which are essentially controlled by the U.S. Navy. If you think about its naval power, whether it's surface ships or submarines, they're similarly having to go through those choke points that can be blockaded at any time of the U.S. choosing. And if you're China, and if you think that it is time to take your rightful place as the world's preeminent superpower, as they think they do, because for much of the human history, of course, China was the richest and most powerful nation in the world. And it is only in the last few hundred years since the Industrial Revolution and, as they call it, the century of humiliation that began with the opium in the 1800s, that they lost that preeminence. Well, they think that this is, you know, just reverting back to the normal state of things where China is going to be the greatest power in the world. Well, you can't allow another power like the United States and its allies to contain you like that, right? To hold you hostage in a way, preventing your military from projecting power across the Pacific, being able to blockade your maritime trade on which you're so reliant on. And if you take Taiwan, you basically uncork yourself because you establish dominance across the whole region. You kick the U.S. Navy all the way back to Hawaii. You project power across the Western Pacific. You are able to now dominate that region in a way that Russia dominates its near abroad, right? The example I use is if you think about what is happening today in the Caucasus, for example, or in Central Asia, where you have these states like Armenia or Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan, they're effectively within Russia's sphere of influence, not because they want to be, but because they have no choice, because they're sitting next to this hugely powerful neighbor. The United States is far away and can't do anything for them. So they have to accommodate Russia to a huge extent on security issues, on trade issues, and so forth. That is what's going to happen in Asia if China is establishing dominance of Taiwan. And that's not a hypothetical. This was literally told to me by senior leaders in that region, senior government officials in Japan and elsewhere, that if China takes Taiwan, regardless of how it takes it, whether it's through coercion or it fights for it and wins and we don't fight for it or we lose, regardless of how, if the outcome is that China controls Taiwan, they tell me that they're basically going to treat it as if they have a new sheriff in town and they're going to have to figure a way to accommodate them on a whole slew of issues, whether it's security, whether it's trade, what have you. And dominating that region where you have 50% of the world's GDP, much of the world's supply chains, much of the world's growth is going to lead to projection of power across the entire world, far eclipsing even what the Chinese do now. And that will be a diminishment of U.S. power and U.S. influence in the world and a retrenchment unlike anything we have seen in the last 120 plus years.
I think something to think through, because when you were articulating how the Chinese feel encircled in terms of U.S. military bases, in the Indo-Pacific in terms of our allies and partners in the region. That reminded me of a lot of the, let's say, post-invasion rationalizations that the Russians have used. We feel, and also there are a lot of Russian-friendly people in the American political system who've made these arguments about, well, the Russians felt contained, they felt threatened, what else were they supposed to do? So how do you suggest that we who are on the pro-Taiwan side acknowledge geopolitical reality of, yeah, China has basically no allies for a variety of complicated reasons? And that would lead me, if I were an aggressor power who doesn't have allies, to see other people as threats. How do you acknowledge this history without providing post-op excuses? Because you and I both know that the first thing that would happen, let's say your invasion scenario happens in 2028, is, I don't want to say China-friendly members of like the US political system, but anti-status quo and anti-establishment members of the US political system who'd be trying to intervene against US intervention in a Taiwan conflict would rapidly say, this is all because the US got too involved in the region. Let's step back. We'd rerun the same Ukraine time, the same Ukraine, Russia, NATO timeline. How should we think about this history?
Yeah, it's a great question. So look, I'm not of the John Mearsheimer view. In fact, I've debated him on this point, that NATO expansion caused the war. But I also am not of the view that it had absolutely nothing to do with it, right? The causes of wars are always complex and multidimensional. And I write in the book that I think there are five reasons for why Putin ultimately chose to invade Ukraine. And I think those five reasons are exactly the reasons why Xi wants to invade Taiwan. And those reasons start with history. Both men are obsessed with history. Putin famously thinks that Ukraine is not a country, erroneously, of course, that it deserves to be part of the Russian Empire. You know, he spent lots of time talking about that, including just recently with Tucker Carlson, where he filibustered for 40 minutes on that topic. She believes that Taiwan is not a country and belongs with China, even though that is erroneous as well, erroneous interpretation of history. The second is destiny, that they think that it is both their countries and their personal destinies to sort of rebuild their empires, in the case of Putin, to be the new Peter the Great that accomplishes this great task of making Russia great again, if you will, to borrow a phrase, or in the Chinese terms, the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation that Xi talks about, of which bringing Taiwan into Chinese orbit is a key component. But you also have security and geography. And I do think that it's a mistake to not appreciate that Russian leadership, long before Putin, was always opposed to NATO expansion, going back to Gorbachev, Yeltsin, and so forth. And again, this is not the only motivating factor, or perhaps not even the most important one, but they do look at Ukraine as a critical buffer state. They've always looked at it that way. Russia has experienced numerous invasions from Europe over its century-long history. Napoleon, Hitler, Teutonic Knights, the Poles, you name it. And many of these invasion routes have gone through Ukraine. And that distance, that critical distance of Ukraine, has enabled Russia to mobilize forces and respond to the attack and prevent, in some of these cases, the fall of Moscow. Not always, but you know, almost famously with Hitler, that was achieved. And the distances from the border of eastern Ukraine to Moscow are not far. In fact, you know, we got to observe that ourselves last year when Prigozhin, with his mutiny, left the Wagner training camps in eastern Ukraine, and within basically half a day of marching, was within the outskirts of Moscow, right? So the Russians are acutely aware of that distance. They acutely appreciate the importance of Ukraine. And by the way, if you're invading, of course, Europe, you're going to get through Ukraine. So both offensively and defensively, Ukraine matters to them. And as I mentioned, Taiwan matters to China, both defensively and offensively. And it's an important element of it. But the most important element is ego for both men, because it's not just about the argument that one day, you know, they want Ukraine to be within the Russian Empire or under Russian control, at least, or Taiwan to be joined with China. Both men believe that this should be accomplished under their watch. They want to take credit for it in the pantheon of history. And both men are in their 70s. Putin turned 70 a couple of years ago. Xi turned 70 last year. And they're looking at both their biological clock and their own mortality. They're looking at how long they can last in power. For Xi, the reason why I think that the window might close for him in 2032 is that he's going to be 79 when he's up for potentially a fifth term as a Communist Party leader. And that may be really tough for him to get that re-election as a 79-year-old. Unlike our system, they don't tend to re-elect leaders into their 80s. So he may face quite a bit of opposition, particularly if the economy keeps going the way it is right now. So if he wants to go into history as a person that eclipsed Mao, that did the one thing that Mao could never do, which is take Taiwan, I think that 28 through 32 window is probably what he's thinking about in terms of being able to get it done.
And the thing, too, with eclipsing Mao, it's that wouldn't just be accomplishing something that Mao didn't accomplish from a pure territorial perspective, because obviously Mao had wanted to bring Taiwan under heel since the 50s. It would be actually eclipsing the United States, succeeding to take Taiwan. Like, so obviously Mao has the Vietnam War, and then there's obviously like the Korean War. Like, those are like military stalemates for the U.S., but actually pushing the U.S. out of that first island chain would represent just like an epical moment of the century that obviously would surpass those previous moments. So I think the useful takeaway from the history you just told here very clearly, and this is where I actually worry a lot, because this bleeds into U.S.-Ukraine policy going back to the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, is a clear articulation of what we're actually aiming to do. So the reason why Putin claiming he had to invade because of NATO, which once again, it's one of his subordinate reasons. This is also another way that Tucker Carlson looked bad during his interview, because he kept trying to get Putin to make the story all about NATO. And Putin's like, yeah, well, that's kind of a thing. But let's really talk about 1066. That's a funny example there. But I think if we just make clear, at no point, there are very few guarantees I could offer about the American political system, other than there is quite literally not one single person in any party in the year 2019 who invading Moscow by way of the Donbass. And the same thing is true here when it comes to China. We are not seeking to humiliate China. We're not seeking to overthrow the Chinese government. There's no invasion of China vis-a-vis the Iraq War, first or second. So just really making clear that all we are trying to do is preserve a peaceful status quo is just really paramount. And I worry that we don't have enough political leaders in the United States who can just succinctly make that argument clear.
That is absolutely fantastic point, because the people that want to overturn the status quo is not in the United States. It is Putin with his invasion of Ukraine, and it's Xi Jinping with his desire to take Taiwan. We want to preserve the global security order. We want to preserve the status quo. We should not be seeking regime change in China. In fact, I think the people that are arguing that the CCP should fall, Xi Jinping should get replaced, are calling for a conflict that is way more than we want to undertake. You know, ultimately, the Chinese people will decide what system of government they want to have. Hopefully, it'll be a democratic and free country, but that's not up to us to decide, and there's nothing we can really do to affect that. I don't believe that winning the Cold War against China requires a regime change in China. If that's how you define victory, you may never get there, because the CCP may last for hundreds of years. I mean, Xi Jinping obviously won't, but that regime may. And we should not be thinking of victory in those terms. Victory should mean deterring China from dominating Asia by way of invading Taiwan and containing their global ambitions. And if we do that, I argue in the book that we have all the advantages to dominate the century like we dominated the last century, to have this be an American century, because China is incredibly weak, right? We're seeing the impact to their economy after reaching the middle income trap, which is a point where every country that effectively reaches $10,000 per capita, as China just recently did, growth stagnates. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that play out right now. The population collapse that they're going to experience the century that they're already starting to undergo is unlike anything we have seen in human history, going down from 1.4 billion people that they have today to maybe 550 million by the end of the century, with many of them being elderly. Just a remarkable collapse of the population and shrinking of the population in that country that's going to affect everything, psychology, the social cohesion of the country, economics, etc. So if we wait it out, we will remain the world's preeminent superpower, one that helps to ensure the global security order, that helps make the world safer for trade and freedom and democracy. We don't have to fight China. I hope we avoid it at all costs, but we can't let them take Taiwan.
So here's the central, not contradiction, but central challenge here. All of the factors that you articulated about the China of 2090 is going to have unfathomable problems in comparison to the China boosterism we saw in the 2000s and the 2010s. But all of those arguments actually are in favor then of China saying, hey, we're peaking. I had Hal Brands and Michael Beckley on to talk about this. We're peaking. This is as strong as we're ever going to be. We need to move now in terms of on Taiwan, in terms of kicking the United States out of the region. So how do we navigate both the long-term prospects we have with the short to medium-term dangers those long-term weaknesses pose for the world?
I think that's right. Although I don't think that Xi is very focused on economics. I think he's a hard power guy. He's focused on his military. And I think that for him, the question will be, can I do this? If I go forward, can I actually succeed? Because the stakes for him are incredibly high. I argue much higher than the stakes for Putin in invading Ukraine, because as I've said from the beginning, Putin can survive losing in Ukraine. In fact, because the objectives that he's defined in that conflict are so ambiguous, right? Denazification, what does that even mean? Demilitarization. He can basically at any moment say, I've achieved that because I never really defined it, proclaim victory and leave. Well, Xi can't do that, right? It's very clear that if the objective is to take Taiwan and you don't take Taiwan, you failed. And a failure like this can really end to the end of him, could end even the CCP and its rule in China. So he will not do this unless he's very certain that he can accomplish this task. And again, as I talk in the book, this is a really, really difficult place to invade. One of the worst places imaginable. It's a natural fortress of an island. In fact, we ourselves in 1945 did not invade Formosa. It was a Japanese occupied island at the time. The Japanese were entrenched on this island. We bypassed and invaded Okinawa because it was so tough. This is not a cakewalk. Amphibious invasions are very, very difficult. Taiwan has 23 million people as its population, about 5 to 6 million are military age males. Now, they're not well-trained. The reserve system needs reform, and they're undergoing through that right now. They need to build up their defenses, no question about it. But this is very, very difficult for him to pull off, and I don't think he's going to go until he has certainty or as much certainty as he can get that he can win.
Something I wonder then, to what degree, and this goes to the difficulty part here, if there's a key lesson everyone's taken from both the lead up to the war in Ukraine, but during the actual war in Ukraine, it's just that surveillance, drones, satellites, intelligence leaks, et cetera, have made it so that it's effectively impossible to launch a surprise invasion, right? Like Putin wasn't just capable of basically deploying his troops. Then one day we wake up and it's, you know, February and there's an invasion. Actually, to what degree would a Chinese invasion be detectable from a buildup perspective? Because I think that's also why folks should really pay attention to the opening story you tell about a probable invasion scenario, because there's a difference between we're launching the biggest amphibious invasion in human history, aka something you would pick up by a satellite, and something that starts smaller, seizes critical infrastructure, and then scales up once you have some base of security on the island. How do you think about the surveillance aspect of this?
No, this would be one of the biggest military operations in history. The preparations for it will take months, and we're going to see a lot of it. Even if our intelligence source in China, you know, may have been curtailed in recent years, and we've seen public reports about the detections of our potential spy networks in China and the like, in part because of operational security mistakes that we have made. But even without that, we would be able to see massive movements of ships from South China Sea to East China Sea, the building of barracks at the port facilities to house the tens of thousands of troops and equipment that you need to load on those ships. That will not be accomplished in a day or 2 days. You will see that over a period of months. But as I argue in the book, that actually may give China an advantage, because the downside of that military buildup is that everyone will know about it. The New York Times and, you know, Washington Post and all the TV networks will be writing about this day in, day out. And the president, whoever is president at the time, will be asked on a daily basis, what are you going to do about this? And will you send American troops to fight for this country? There'll probably be congressional hearings on this issue, right? So China will get incredible amount of intelligence about what is the U.S. going to do here? Is it going to get involved? Is the U.S. moving its aircraft carriers to the region, pre-positioning fighter jets, equipment, munitions, and the like? Or is it sort of pulling back, right? And if you compare this to the buildup on Ukraine's borders by Russia in 21 and 22, President Biden ruled out at the outset that we would send American troops to fight for Ukraine, right? So Putin knew that in advance. Will that happen with China? Because let me tell you, if Xi Jinping gets certainty that America is not fighting, well, this becomes much, much easier for him, right? He can take Taiwan probably even today if he knows that America is not coming to Taiwan's aid. He doesn't know that, which is why he's got all these dilemmas about confronting the U.S. Navy, confronting the U.S. bases, what to do about that. But if in that buildup, he gets that level of certainty one way or another, either we're fighting or not fighting, that gives him a lot of clarity. Because if, for example, if he knows that we are going to fight for Taiwan, well, then he can choose to hit us first, potentially strike with missiles our bases in Okinawa, our bases in Guam, and then move on Taiwan. So that gives him a lot of optionality.
You know, I'm curious about that. So this wasn't your version of China didn't choose to do this during the scenario you described in the past, at the start of the book, but it seems the decision to launch strikes on American forces in Guam, in Okinawa, et cetera, for example, how do you think through how a Chinese consider expanding the scope of that war? Because if you look at just the basic historical examples, Japan, 1941, obviously you have the Germans and the U-boat campaign and then the Zimmerman telegram. Obviously, like the USS Maine was actually sank by an accident, not by the Spanish, but like when Americans are killed every single time, and then September 11th, we are going to go in. And it seems as if the real objective, and I guess what I would do if I were the Chinese, and because when you think about this, and this is where the nuclear bit comes in, I would copy one of the most effective parts of Vladimir Putin's playbook, which was say this is an existential question for me and my country, and say this is so existential that we will bring in tactical or strategic nuclear weapons into any Taiwan question, which Putin has proven you don't even have to actually do. I think there are very few, if any, actual moments where Putin was going to actually use tactical nuclear weapons in response to the U.S. supply of Ukrainian with Ukrainian arms. But just the political threat is just such that during that buildup, there is not a politician in the American system today who I think would feel comfortable, especially during an election year, saying, no, we think this is worth taking the risk of a nuclear strike. So how do you think about that takeaway?
No, absolutely. I mean, look, the last thing that China wants to do is fight the United States military. It's doing everything in its power today to try to deter us from intervening in that conflict. It's trying to build leverage economically over us. It's trying to build up its forces to make it clear to us that the cost for us in fighting that conflict would be unimaginable in terms of loss of lives. I mean, you look at some of the potential scenarios here, we could lose more people in the first few days of this war than we ever lost during World War II in terms of a single day casualty numbers, right? Mm-hmm. That's the order of magnitude of casualties we're talking about here. We have to go all the way back probably to the Civil War to even think about anything on that scale of loss. So that is going to be the Chinese strategy, is to tell us that if you intervene economically, militarily, this will be an enormous cost to you. And what for, right? You know, this is our island, butt out, we're going to take it. Whether it works or not remains to be seen, but this is clearly something they've been working on for so long.
Okay, so three big last questions here. We'll go one at a time. So I think an interesting way of bringing your deterrence objective into context is basically saying, a way of understanding the 2014 to 2022 period is following Russia's invasion of Crimea, the US and her allies and NATO broadly failed to deter further action from the Russians in terms of actually invading the country beyond Crimea. What lessons can we take from 2014 to 2022 that should inform how we seek to deter China over the next 4, 5, 6, maybe even 10 years?
That's a great question. So we did not use our full economic power, of course, to punish Russia for that invasion. And that is why after 2014...
And you mean Crimea, the Crimean invasion.
The Crimean invasion. And the Donbass, frankly, as well. But takeaway that Putin got out of that conflict is that he can withstand U.S. sanctions. He can withstand U.S. export controls. In fact, he sort of had this misguided view that since 2014, because he had ordered sort of a diversification of his industries away from Western technologies, that that was actually accomplished. Of course, much of it was not done. And he thought that the impact on him and his economy would be much less. Now, when you look at what's happening now, we did not go all out on sanctions or even export controls. They're still able to procure a lot of capabilities, a lot of CNC machines, for example, that are necessary to for manufacturing of their missiles and armored vehicles and jet fighters and the like. Even though we've instituted export controls on semiconductor imports into Russia, exports to Russia, they're still able to procure them, not in as huge quantities as they could before the war, but nevertheless, they're able to put their economy on a war footing and make sure that everything gets prioritized for the defense industrial base. But from a sanctions perspective, very few companies in Russia are actually sanctioned. I think most people don't appreciate that only the companies tied to the defense sector are under sanctions. Much of the oil and gas sector is not under sanctions. We allow them to export oil and gas because we don't want to have the economic impact that we would otherwise have if we had sanctioned their industries like that. So the lesson, I think, from the Russian invasion of Ukraine is that if you're going to do something, if you're actually going to use your deterrent power, you have to use it fully. And we have to be in a much better position vis-a-vis the Chinese economy than we are today to make that threat credible. I argue that we should not be engaging in decoupling or de-risking, which is really another word for, you know, maybe selective decoupling that is often used in this town and in Europe. But what we should be focused on is what I call unidirectional entanglement. Full decoupling from China is A, not possible, most of our allies would not go on board with it. But C is actually counterproductive because it reduces our leverage over them, right? If our economies are completely disconnected. But if you think about a situation where we are less dependent on them in critical industries and critical minerals, but they are more dependent on us on things like semiconductors, on AI technology, on biotech and synthetic biology, on energy, that gives us leverage over them. So we need to make sure that we are engaging in smart policies that in four critical industries that I talk about in the book that we dominate: AI and autonomy, biotech and synthetic biology, space technology, and energy technology, particularly green tech energy. And the two components that feed those technologies, which are semiconductors, chips, and critical minerals, everything from rare earths to nickel, cobalt, and the like that you need for modern manufacturing. And today it's very much a mixed bag where we are ahead in some areas and we are losing or about to lose in others. And we need to engage in both investment in innovation in this country, but also protecting it against Chinese IP theft that they've been engaging in on an unimaginable scale for decades now. We should be sanctioning their companies that are benefiting from this intellectual property theft. We should be protecting our economies from their overcapacity and dumping in things like EVs, batteries, and a whole slew of technologies that they're trying to dominate.
To what degree do you think a lack of resolution to the war in Ukraine would pose a severe strategic hindrance on the U.S. in this scenario you're describing?
Well, unfortunately for Ukraine, and we've already seen this play out over the last 6 months, that any distraction for the United States means less support and less focus on Ukraine, right? As we saw the conflict in the Middle East arise, you've seen delays in aid coming to Ukraine. You've seen less focus on Ukraine in our media. And look, if we're fighting a war with China, everything else is on the back burner, right? If the war is still going on by that time between Russia and Ukraine, you know, I don't think Ukraine is going to get anything from us because all of our resources are going to be focused on this existential fight with China, right? So hopefully we can sort out this conflict before then and get it in a better position. But I'm not too optimistic. Unfortunately, this war has been going on for 10 years already, since 2014, with various levels of intensity. It could unfortunately easily go for another 10. And Putin has now reoriented his country for the long haul. In fact, he's sort of made this war existential for his own regime because he's positioned himself as the guy that's fighting NATO, that's fighting the West, even though, he's not doing that. But to the Russian population, that's the argument he's making. So he's getting close to the position where he's going to need this war politically versus actually trying to get it to come to an end.
So it seems like from a political perspective, one of the key tasks for any American administration going into 2025 is just very much, not just in a Trumpian sense, but making clear to the Europeans who hold Ukraine's interests at heart that this won't even be like an ideological debate come 2027, 2028. Clearly, there's going to have to be a backstopping or a transition in responsibility when it comes to the Russian side of this, because this can't be a multi-front situation from the American perspective. So, okay, so last two quick questions. So number one, you focused a bit when you talked about the economic position and the decoupling issues, but to what degree do you think the U.S. can make itself more resilient in the next 2 years, almost at a crash level? Because the clear takeaway from COVID, especially as someone who's coming to this from a political economy perspective, is if the U.S. wasn't resilient enough from a supply chain, from an energy, from all these different issues perspective during COVID, this conflict you're describing, if it's failed to be deterred, is that on steroids? So what can we do to be more resilient domestically when all of our actual business and governmental level incentives are to act as if everything's fine and we should focus on efficiency over resiliency?
Well, there's not a lot we can do to make ourselves more resilient from Taiwan, because the reality is that for the foreseeable future, we're not reducing our dependence on semiconductors being produced from Taiwan. The quantities are too huge. The advantages that they have in terms of cheap labor, the infrastructure and supply chains that they've built are not going to get replicated here anytime soon. I think this is a common misconception about the CHIPS Act, this industrial policy we've engaged in over the last few years, that is very important, and I'm a huge supporter of it. But that policy is not designed to make ourselves independent of Taiwan or Korea or elsewhere on semiconductors. It is designed to stem the slow degradation of the semiconductor industry in the United States, where our share cheap production have been steadily declining for decades. It is around 12% today. And if everything just works perfectly with this CHIPS Act, which is, you know, not a foregone conclusion, we might be able to get to maybe 20%, right? But we're not achieving independence in production. Taiwan is going to matter to the world when it comes to semiconductors for a very, very, very long time. But when it comes to China, we can reduce our dependence on them for green energy technologies, don't allow them to dominate our country and allied countries with their cheap EVs, don't allow them to achieve dominance in battery technology, wind and solar, all these green tech technologies that we're going to be dependent on as we transition off fossil fuels. Make sure that they can't achieve their own chip breakout. They're not able to produce chips sufficient enough for their own domestic purposes, both advanced and foundational chips that are necessary for your weapon systems and really everything else that you need semiconductors for. Reduce the dependence on critical minerals. The good news is that we and our allies have plenty of mining capacity around the world to mine for both rare earths. We have a rare earth mine here in North America that is operational in California called the Mountain Pass mine that has been producing rare earths in this country since the late 1940s. But we're not processing them all. We're shipping them to China for processing. Well, we need to invest in processing capacity. We need to do the same thing for other critical minerals and reduce China's ability to threaten us and deter us from trying to intervene on the behalf of the Taiwanese and deter this conflict.
So last question, the show has a really intense policymaker and their staff-minded audience. So if you could tell that side of the audience, like what are two or three or even one thing they could focus on that's within their control when it comes to this deterrence question? What would you really emphasize should be taken away from your book to focus on?
Well, we need to do a lot on the defense side. And I write in the book that we need to reform our defense industrial base. And one of the main problems we have in our defense industrial base, there are many certainly, but one of the main ones is that we've become too enamored with buying incredibly exquisite, highly capable, but extraordinarily expensive weapons platforms that we just can no longer afford to procure in large quantities, that we need to get back to the basics, that the most expensive is not necessarily the best at this point, and we need to double down on proven technologies that are cheap and effective and that we can produce in mass quantities. That's number one. And number two, we really need to make sure that, again, from a trade perspective, that we prevent Chinese overcapacity in certain sectors, particularly around green tech and semiconductors, from destroying our industry. We need to work with allies to institute trade barriers to prevent them from dumping their products on our markets, wiping our manufacturing base. That's going to be really important for deterrence.
Dmitry, this has been really great. Can you just do a quick shout out to the book that listeners and viewers should pick up after they listen to this conversation?
Thank you, Marshall. The book is called World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China for the race for the 21st century, in the race for the 21st century, available April 30th. Hope people buy it and review it as well on Amazon, Goodreads, and everywhere else.
Thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.